This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, over the rainbow, gotta let it go. So bold, rain is a gun. Fast to freedom,
stars tonight.
Back to Open the Voice Gate, Rewind and Rewatch, episode 24, covering Untouchable 2011 from Chicago, Illinois at the Congress Theater on September 10th, 2011. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling feed or on our own dedicated podcast feed on all podcast platforms and applications. You can find us on Twitter at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to give a donation to the show, it's certainly not required, but it'd be greatly appreciated. Just click the link in the show notes. It will take you to Red Circle, where you will hit the red button that says sponsor the show. You can do a one-time or reoccurring donation. And again, anything would be appreciated, not required. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Iron Mike Spears. And I'm joined, as always, by Case Lowe. And Case, we are now getting to the point where we're back in Chicago only for like the first time this year. And it feels like it's been so long since Dragon Gate USA has been back at the Congress Theater.
You know what's nice? We're back in Chicago in Dragon Gate USA, and this is the first Rewind and Rewatch show that I have done in Chicago. We started this series when I moved back to Indiana for COVID concerns. I am now back in Chicago. School year about to start. Happy to be here, and we are back in the Congress Theater. You're right, a venue that we haven't visited since Bryan Danielson was on the shows. We are now back, and it feels like a completely different universe than the show that we previously watched from this building.
Yeah, like this weekend, like we've always talked about, like when is this going to get to the Dragon Gate USA that like we more recognize later on. We are now pretty much fully in that as well. This is an interesting time both in Dragon Gate USA, but it's also an incredible time in DGUS and Dragon Gate proper. So over in Japan, last week we caught ourselves up to the big events that were happening. We focused a little bit on Kobe World, but there was a lot of stuff that happened beforehand. We also talked about the 6-8 Korakuen, but that was in the middle of June. There's a lot of stuff that went on between June and September in Dragon Gate.
Yeah, so last week we talked about all of the title changes that occurred in Japan, as well as the 6-8 Korakuen show. This week, we start with the June 12th Kobe Sambo Hall show, and we will go through everything of note until we hit, I guess, the second week of September when these shows took place. So there's a lot of Japan coverage to get to. And like I said, we start on June 12th in Kobe Sambo Hall. The main things of note on this show, Masato Yoshino defeating Ricochet in a singles match. Akira Tozawa and Yasushi Kanda, well, they wrestled Masaki Mochizuki and Shingo Takagi in a tag match. Not only did the Blood Warrior side win, but Akira Tozawa pinned his former Kamikaze stablemate in Shingo Takagi. And then your main event, Shima, Doi, and Hulk defeated Yamato, Dragon Kid, and Gamma. It should be noted coming out of this show, after his loss, Shingo demanded a singles match with Tozawa. He said he wanted to be repaid, for Tozawa to pay his debt here in Kobe, and so the match was made for Kobe World 2011. First match announced for the show is Shingo versus Tozawa. And then after the main event, Blood Warriors in Junction 3 agreed next month in Osaka on July 3rd to have a 5-match series to see who the better team is. Shima said he doesn't care if it's a 99-match series. Blood Warriors will sweep them. From there, like I mentioned last week, we go to Fukuoka for the Champion Gate shows, at which Pac retained his Brave Gate title against Ricochet, and Yoshino, Gamma, and Yamato defeated Shima, Doi, and Hulk for the vacant Open the Triangle Gate belt, and then the next night, Dragon Kid and Pac won the Twin Gate belts from Ryo Saito and Genki Horiguchi, and Masaki Mochizuki pulled off a miracle and had a match of the year contender against Yasushi Kanda. And Mike, I'm not on an island saying that Mochizuki versus Kanda match is unbelievably good, correct?
No. This is probably Kanda's best singles match ever.
Yes, I would say so.
I don't think that's a wild statement. And you know that it's something that, like, they have these Champion Gate shows that basically, like, they had this up there. And if anything really should put people to reassess Masaki Mochizuki, go watch the show from June 19th in 2011 in Fukuoka, because he did masterwork there. And then everything that they've started to build up on these set of shows, like, you had Yoshino and Kanda. I'm sorry, you had Tozawa and Kanda against Masaki Mochizuki and Shingo Takagi. Like, at this point, that's the biggest win of Tozawa's career, was against Shingo in that match. And I remember that main event where you basically had everyone who was betrayed on one side and the betrayers on the other side in the main event being something that was really cool. I mean, they almost went half an hour in that match, which is something that's, like, wild to think of at this time, like having a 27-minute Kobe Sambo Hall main event. But it was really, really solid stuff. And then, you know, it was full board from there into July and into what was called the Prefectorial Gym number 2. I think this was right before it became known as Bodymaker, but it's still at the time was Prefectorial Gym number 2 for the their full confrontation. They had, like, one of the first full confrontation shows that they would have in this feud.
Yeah, I actually think by the time they ran there in November, it was the Bodymaker Coliseum. I'm not positive, but I think by that November show, which we will talk about during the next Triple Shot, one of the great Dragon Gate shows of all time, I believe it is Bodymaker number 2 at that point. But July 3rd in Osaka, we get the KZ return match to start the show. Naoki Tanizaki and KZ beating Don Fuji and Starker Ichikawa with the Adios Motherfucker, a move named after the implant impact combination, the most vulgar finish in all of wrestling. As I believe we talked about on the show either last week or 2 weeks ago, there was an international high flyer three-way match with Ricochet defeating Rich Swann and Pac in a rematch of the Uprising 2011 main event. That show was also in your podcast feed if you have not heard the review of that. And then we began the Blood Warriors versus Junction 3 five-match series. It started with the Junction 3 team of Kagetora and Gamma winning against Genki Horiguchi and Tomahawk TT. Blood Warriors evened it up as Kanda defeated Super Shisa. Junction 3 pulled ahead 2-1 as Susumu Yokosuka defeated Naruki Doi. And then Akira Tozawa, who was unstoppable at this point, he and Cyber Kong evened it up at 2-2 after they defeated Yamato and Shingo Takagi, and once again Tozawa pinned Takagi. And then your main event to settle the score, Shima, BB Hulk, and Saito of Blood Warriors. They defeated Mochizuki, Yoshino, and Dragon Kid of Junction 3, an electric Osaka number 2 show.
Yeah, and, like, the big thing about this series, and when we say, like, this is the company hanging on full gears, they use this show to set up Kobe World in a fantastic manner, because you had Blood Warriors. They lose the first two matches, but then they sweep the three world skirmishes. And the Adios Motherfucker, like, the interesting thing about that is, if you're someone who's not too familiar with Naoki Tanizaki, he does the Impact, which is a version of the Omori Driver. So they would basically do the same move to the same person, where it was, like, one person on one side, one person on the other side. It looked very vulgar, so it made sense that they had that. And, you know, this was a really, like, powerful show, because, again, you had Shingo Takagi taking the fall against Akira Tozawa in this match that was a rematch of Kamikaze members, looking at it. And it's just, like, this time is, like, one of the peak times in the company. I feel like we see that each time. And then that goes into a Cork and Hall show, which, after the big month they had beforehand, had a pretty stacked card. That, I mean, the big thing here is that they had a big move. Like, when you talk about this show and you break down the matches, they were still able to sell out Corkin with this thing, which is like a big step forward considering who all they have in the semi-main and the main event.
Yeah, July 8th, 2011, Corkin Hall. It starts with the Mike Spears dream match, Susumu Yokosuka and Pac defeating Taku Iwasa and Kenichiro Arai. That has your name written all over it. It also should be noted the bonus battle rap in which Rich Swann defeated KZ. That would become a frequent occurrence for pretty much the rest of the year of Dragon Gate forcing KZ and Rich Swann to rap against one another. Naruki Doi, Ryo Saito, and Genki Horiguchi defeated Masato Yoshino, Super Shisa, and the aforementioned Rich Swann. Don Fuji and Stalker Ichikawa defeated Naoki Tanizaki and KZ when Stalker Ichikawa pinned KZ. So if you look at that through 2020 eyes, the progress that KZ has made is absolutely incredible. There, Cyber Kong defeated Kagetora, Shima, Kanda, and Ricochet defeated Mochizuki, Dragon Kid, and Gamma. And then, as Mike mentioned, the semi-main event and the main event, Yamato defeats Akira Tozawa, and BB Hulk knocks out Shingo Takagi with the first flash. A loaded Corkin Hall show, Mike.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing, like, touching on, like, KZ and Sakura Ichikawa, this was a build-up for their Kobe World match, where it was KZ, Tanizaki, and Tomahawk versus Don Fuji, Sakura Ichikawa, and Yoshihiro Takayama. So, like, this was, like, not just, like, a comedy match. Like, this was a thing, like, because they were bringing in Takayama as, like, their outsider for Kobe World 2011. And, yeah, it's just, like, such a big thing, like, the idea of you have, like, the four, like, least tested members of the Toriumon, Dragon System, Big Six in the main events, and still being able to put on a show like that.
Yeah, so after Tozawa was defeated, Yamato essentially bragged and said Tozawa should go back to the U.S. for another 10 years or so. And then Cyber Kong jumped Yamato, Tozawa hit the Package German, KZ counted a mock pinfall, and then Cyber Kong fled to the back with Yamato's Open the Triangle Gate belt. And then after the main event, BB Hulk mocked Shingo Takagi, swore his mighty kicks would essentially knock out Masaki Mochizuki, and then Mochizuki came out and said, "Hey, your post-match promos still suck," and Blood Warriors left. And Mike, that brings us to Kobe World 2011, which is one of the greatest shows of all time.
Yeah, no, this show, I mean, the attendance here is obviously worked. They say it's 9,400, but probably was about 68,000 to 7,000. And when you, like, look at this show, even, like, the undercard matches all had a lot of spice to it. Just, like, up and down, all seven matches on the show, you have some incredible stuff going here. And, you know, it's one of those shows that I believe still is up on the network if you're looking to see it. It is worth going back and revisiting pretty much from... The Yoshihiro Takayama showing up is such a wild thing that I encourage to watch it. But basically, from match four on, it was just straight bangers.
Well, I like match number two a lot. I think it's a legitimately good match. But the show starts, it's Iwasa and Arai. They defeat Kagetora and Super Shisa. Then, as I mentioned, Ryo Saito and Genki Horiguchi, they defeat Susumu Yokosuka and Rich Swann in a really fun match. Swann obviously gets to rap in front of the Kobe faithful, which is great to see. And then there is that Don Fuji, Stalker Ichikawa, and Yoshihiro Takayama versus Tanizaki, KZ, and Tomahawk TT match that is second to none. I mean, Takayama, oh man, I miss him being able to move. I mean, it sucks. His presence, even as he got older, was still such a welcome sight in Japanese wrestling, and what has happened with his health issues is so unfortunate. He was great in that match. And then things pick up. Triangle Gate match, Yamato, Yoshino, and Gamma. They defeat Doi, Kanda, and Cyber Kong. Akira Tozawa pins Shingo Takagi in a 16-minute singles match. Shima and Ricochet defeat Dragon Kid and Pac for the Open the Twin Gate belts. As I said last week, this is a 5-star match, one of the 5 greatest matches in Dragon System history, in my opinion, and the main event is not that far behind it, with Masaki Mochizuki defeating BB Hulk in a brilliant match.
Yeah, and the big thing is about, like, the semi-main and main event. We've talked about this on the weekly update show when people are asking us what to watch from these Kobe Samba Hall show, or these Kobe World Hall shows. That's two completely different venues, Mike. you look at like this, you look at like match five on, Akira Tozawa in like the big showcase singles match beats Shingo Takagi really definitively in a 4.5-star match. Shima and Ricochet versus Dragon Kid and Pac might be one of the top three tag matches in the company's history. I know you have it as a top five match. I don't know if I go that far, but it's definitely one of the best like 2-on-2 tag matches of all time in the Dragon system. And then Mochizuki and Hulk just go to war for half an hour, and it ends with Mochizuki kicking off BB Hulk's head. And it's just a tremendous way. And something that's worth noting as we talk about 2011, Ricochet gets the direct fall on Pac in the semi-main event.
Yeah, huge. Something that will come into the show we're about to talk about. Some people don't like that main event. I think they're out of their mind. That is just such a marvelous performance from both men. And it should also be noted, after the Twin Gate match, Naoki Tanizaki came out. He attacked Pac. He took the Brave Gate belt from him. He said that since Pac is going to go back to England, Tanizaki kind of declared himself, in a sense, the new Open the Brave Gate champion. And Junction 3... enlisted the trust of Rich Swann to get the belt back, and that led us to July 24th in Kyoto KBS Hall on a show that also, I guess we'll start here with the Blood Warriors authorized Bravegate match, Naoki Tanizaki defeating Rich Swann, one of the few times that a heel group has taken control of the Bravegate belt and has completely just changed the belt and the stipulations around it. Obviously, Open the Gamma Gate was a thing. And also on this show, the conclusion of the tournament to decide Don Fuji's tag partner in the Summer Adventure Tag League when Kotoka defeated Eita Kobayashi. This was a tournament involving Kotoka, Yosuke Watanabe, Eita Kobayashi, and Shisa Boy. Kotoka went over on Shisa Boy the night before. Watanabe went to a draw with Eita, and it was decided that Watanabe would advance. Unfortunately, he was too injured to compete, so Eita slid into that spot, and then Kotoka defeated Eita to team with Don Fuji in the upcoming Summer Adventure Tag League.
Yeah, so this kind of became a trend for Yosuke Watanabe, currently known as Yosuke Samaria, that Watanabe's early career injured a whole lot. Like, in and out, became Super Shenlong 3, was injured a lot. Super Shenlong 3 became Maria, and finally kind of had some consistency there. Eita Kobayashi, I think you all know who that is. That's Eita. And this is, if you look at Eita like this, completely different Eita then. And then, yeah, like, the idea that, because Pac was going back to the UK for a bit. I don't think he comes back. He hasn't come back, I think, until did he come back for the Cork and Hall show in August? No. He's I think he comes back after the tour in America, I believe, right?
That sounds right, yes. My search and find is not working properly right now, so I couldn't look ahead on the cards. But yeah, it would not appear that Pac is back through the rest of the shows we're talking about.
Yeah. So it's something where it made sense that they did this. I mean, it was a lot more common for them to jerk around the Brave Gate in this manner. And then, like, they liked Swan immediately, putting him in, like, in this. And, of course, it was kind of seen a little bit as a joke match, but, you know, that was important. And then the idea that Kotoka, this is, like, one of the many times where, like, they started to start up Kotoka. And, like, him teaming with Don Fuji makes sense in that regard.
Yeah, so that leads us to the Summer Adventure Tag League 2011, also known as the BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa Vanity Tournament. This was a single elimination tournament instead of the block format that they had used previously. Shima and Ricochet decided to boycott the tournament, so that left us with teams representing Junction 3 with Masaki Mochizuki and Yamato, Masao Yoshino and Dragon Kid, Shingo Takagi and Susumu Yokosuka, Gamma and Rich Swann, and Super Shisa and Kagetora. And then on the Blood Warrior side, Naruki Doi and Yasushi Kanda, Ryo Saito and Genki Horiguchi, BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa, Naoki Tanizaki and KZ, and Cyber Kong and Tomahawk TT. And then there were two unaffiliated teams in Awasa and Arai and Don Fuji and Kotoka. And Mike, that leads us to the kickoff of the Summer Adventure Tag League, August 3rd, Cork and Hall. Shima Tanizaki and KZ win the opener against Shisa Boy, Super Sinlong, and Yosuke Watanabe. Kagetora defeats AR Fox in his Cork and Hall debut. And then we begin the Summer Adventure Tag League format with Shingo and Susumu defeating Cyberkrong and Tomahawk TT, BB Hulk and Tozawa defeating Awasa and Arai, Doi and Kanda beating Fuji and Kotoka. And right before the main event, it was decided Shima took it upon himself to book himself in another match, a loser stays home next month match, where the loser of the fall would have to miss the next Korakuen, where Masato Yoshino, Gamma, and Rich Swan and Dragon Kid, they defeated Shima, Tanizaki, Metal Warrior, and KZ, who took the fall, so KZ would have to miss the next Korakuen. And then your main event, Masaki Mochizuki and Yamato defeating Ryo Saito and Genki Horiguchi.
So this tournament really is like the crystallization of Hulk and Akira. Like you talked about this being kind of like the glorified Hulk and Akira show, and it started immediately. I mean, the idea that Araiwa, which has just basically been doing openers game, they got completely dismantled in 14 minutes. Like it's something where it is completely, you know, that they took the Awasa would not stay too long in the company. Awasa would be retired again before we're done here. And then Mochizuki and Yamato defeating like the most recent Twin Gate champions in the main event was kind of a big thing. And then, you know, the go home opener, we'll talk very quickly at the end of this about what happened at the end of that. So, you know, this is an interesting thing. Like Kagetora and AR Fox, I don't think this match may tape, but I want to see, like, I want to think it may tape because I remember these two things happening, but it might be me transposing what I think that match would be in my brain into actual things that happened.
I think there's a full version of this Cork and Hall out there somewhere. I feel like I've seen that match because I tried to track down as much Foxes in Japan as I could.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, this is something like, and it's also something notable. This was not a sellout in Cork and for this tournament.
Well, I think there's a reason they don't do the Summer Adventure Tag League anymore, so that would make sense. Then go to Osaka number 2 on the 6th. And the tournament matches for that show, Doi and Kanda defeat Gamma and Rich Swan. Mochizuki and Yamato defeat Tanizaki and KZ. Hulk and Tozawa defeat Shisa and Kagetora. Yoshino and Dragon Kid defeat Shingo and Susumu. And Cyberkong, who was in the opener on this show, he made a challenge for the Open the Dreamgate title that Masaki Mochizuki held. He ended up facing off with all 10 members of Junction 3 in an arm wrestling challenge. He defeated the first 9 easily, prompting Mochizuki to accept the match. He didn't arm wrestle. He said his power came from his legs. So Mochizuki versus Cyberkong for the Open the Dreamgate belt was set. And that leads us to the conclusion of the Summer Adventure Tag League on August 7th in Aichi, with the semifinals of Hulk and Tozawa defeating Yoshino and Dragon Kid, and Mochizuki and Yamato defeating Doi and Kanda, and then the Summer Adventure Tag League finals, Akira Tozawa and BB Hulk, they defeat Masaki Mochizuki and Yamato when Tozawa pins Yamato.
Yeah, that match ruled.
Very good.
Like, it's very good. Like, Mochizuki and Yamato never had, like, a full-length tag team, but they kind of worked together as, like, two shoot-style guys. And this is also at a point where we'll talk about in the show where Yamato's kind of drifting out. You know, like this is kind of where Yamato, we talked last week, Yamato's starting to disappear a little bit. And, you know, Tozawa keeps on having constant wins against Yamato. And it's going to become something really big in the fall. So in the next like triple shot, when we talk about Japan, we'll be talking a lot about Tozawa versus Yamato.
Yeah, so after that, we go to Kobe Sambo Hall, August 14th, in a show that, because it's Sambo Hall, I'm sure it made tape. What I don't know is if matches 2 and 3 aired, and if they did, I would certainly love to see them, where match 2, Naruki Doi defeated Rich Swan in a 9-minute singles match, and then match 3, Akira Tozawa defeated Super Shisa in a 15-minute singles match, but the main thing on the show was the Triangle Gate Junction 3 versus Junction 3 match, where Yamato, Yoshino, and Gamma defeated Mochizuki, Shingo, and Dragon Kid. And then Mike, what happened after the main event of this show? What was bestowed upon Kobe Sambo Hall after the Open the Triangle Gate match?
Well, something that would shake Dragon Gate's history. Something that to this day, we will be coming up on the 10th anniversary of this. We've passed the 10th anniversary of this debuting, but we'll come across the 10th anniversary of this match tomorrow as we are recording. We had the debut of Doi Darts, and he says they unveiled this as inspired by the Yoshino lottery. We talked about this when Yoshino was champion. He would draw balls to see who the next challenger was. So he made a dart board featuring all 11 members of Blood Warriors. He had two boards, and the rule is that the three he would hit would be the Blood Warriors challenge team against Yamato, Yoshino, and Gamma. The two boards, one of them was just like a little sliver that I think I want to say might have had, I'm trying to think who would have been the person that would put on that sliver at that time. I don't remember, but 95% of it was Doi, and the rest of it on the other two boards were pretty evenly split for nine people. And he threw darts, so he got himself, and then he hit Tanizaki and KZ, and now we have Team Doi Darts as they would be being the next Triangle Gate challengers, and Dragon Gate would not be the same again as Naruki Doi has delved into his obsession with spinning dart boards.
After that, we hit Fukuoka and Hakata Star Lanes, August 21st, 2011. The thing on this show, well, there's a semi-main event of Shingo and Yamato against BB Hulk and Akira Tozawa, in which Yamato got his win back on Tozawa. But what is important here is the main event, Masaki Mochizuki defeating Cyber Kong. Earlier in the year, we just talked about how Mochizuki gave Kanda the best singles match of his life. Mike, I think this is the best Cyber Kong singles match ever.
Yeah, and I think when people go back and reassess the decades of 2010s, Masaki Mochizuki deserves to be in the conversation for the best wrestler of the decade, because he manages to have two wrestlers who Kong was hit and miss at this point. We did not reach the nadir of Takashi Yoshida, but before Kobe World, he had the best match of Yuzushi Kanda's career, and then he had the best singles match of Cyber Kong's career. Given that his New Hazard Triangle Gate team was a lot of fun. Like, it's up there. Like, it's either this match or the Kobe World 2007 match are the best matches in Cyber Kong's career.
So that is the only thing of note on the Hakata Star Lane show. But in August of 2011, there were two Korakuen Hall shows. So we go back to Korakuen August 25th for a show that featured Dragon Kid and Super Shisa defeating Tomahawk TT and Tomahawk KZ. Don Fuji defeating Kotoka, getting revenge for the embarrassment that was the Summer Adventure Tag League. Shima and Kanda defeating Mochizuki and Rich Swan. Another Blood Warriors authorized Open the Brave Gate match with Tanizaki defeating Gamma. And Tanizaki only needed a two count to win that match. We had in match five the Kness return match, where Saito and Horiguchi defeated Kness and Yokosuka, as well as Taku Iwasa and Kenichiro Arai. And then a huge main event, Nombre contra Nombre Nanawa style elimination match, Doi, Hulk, Tozawa, and Kong defeated Yamato, Kagetora, Yoshino, and Shingo, and one of the many great Blood Warriors versus Junction 3 multi-man matches.
Yeah, so the reason why KZ was KZ and did not stay home was because there was a quote-unquote injury, and he had to become as Tomahawk KZ for the night, because that's a different person, clearly. This three-way tag, but of course, there's a lot of my guys in there. You know, Kness coming back, I mean, Kness had a pretty good stretch from, like, 2011 through the end of the Jimmies, where he was around a lot more. So, like, that was nice seeing. You had Marahi Asapa, you had Nesca, and you had Araiwa going against. But this Nanawa elimination match, which is just like an insane match, is over the top rope. And you're entered by, like, you start off with two people in the ring, and then one side gets advantage, and they come in, and then they throw people out. The thing is that they all stand by the entryway and sprint into the ring. And the big thing about this match was it was a Nanawa-style elimination match. But since Yoshida won the thing to give the heels the advantage, they decided to name it the Yoshida one, because even at that time we knew that Cyber Kong's last name was Yoshida. And the match ruled like 34 minutes. I think the Infinity Cut had like 27 of it. And I mean, they go 23 minutes before there's a single elimination. And then they all, like, over the next 10 minutes, it's nonstop. At this time, you remember how I said like Yamato has a hell of a spear? I forgot that Musha Kakeshi is his name for a spear. Like, it was a finishing move at that time, so I was being smart about it. And notably, Tozawa eliminated Takagi, and Tozawa got the win at the end against Yamato in the package German suplex. The the straitjacket. So, I mean, this was a great Cork and Hall show. Like, and I feel like I'm saying this a lot, but this was a really strong one. And then they announced that Pac was coming back to Japan and that he wants the match. Tanizaki won the match under two count rules. So I think we'll be talking about that in the next show because he will be coming back by then.
Yeah, so we get to the final Dragon Gate proper show that we'll be discussing on this portion, the September 2nd Kobe Sambo Hall show, in which the main event was the Open the Triangle Gate match, where Noriki Doi, Naoki Tanizaki, and KZ, they defeated the champions Yamato, Yoshino, and Gamma. After the match, Gamma demanded an immediate rematch. Mochizuki threw his name in the hat as well for the challenging team. KZ demanded that Swan also join in, so you were looking at a Gamma-Mochizuki-Swan team. It looked like it would happen on the next Sambo Hall show in October, but Doi declined and made the match non-title. He also announced that the next Doi Darts would happen there. And there's a note that Doi Darts also has its own t-shirt now. And the other thing to come out of this show is the main event for Gate of Destiny, which would be in October, so we'll talk about that a few shows from now, was announced. A hair versus mask six-way cage match, Tozawa, Hulk, Cyber Kong, Yamato, Shingo, and Kagetora. I can't wait to rewatch this match and then talk about it all on the podcast because it plays directly into the next Dragon Gate USA triple shot.
Yeah, so Team Doi Darts becomes a huge thing. By the end of this like title run, they all would dress up as Doi. They all would be wearing short tights and a Doi Darts t-shirts. It's wild how over Doi Darts was. Like, it's one of those things that Naruki Doi like found something just stupid and made it super popular. And, you know, like that it became such a big thing that, I mean, they still do Doi Darts matches a decade later because it becomes like a trademark thing. Is that Naruki Doi, he is a wife guy. He loves golf. But one thing he loves above all else is dartboards.
Well, Mike, before we get into Dragon Gate USA, there were two shows that happened in Shinkiba First Ring on September 7th and September 8th. You recently perhaps re-unearthed some of these shows in the past few weeks. Would you like to break down the September 7th and September 8th shows, the Byuden Again Masaki Mochizuki Presents cards?
So, if you're someone that has liked kind of the reemergence of shoot style in UWFI in the States and you've gone back and watched Battle Arts, these are shows worth checking out just because these were like Masaki Mochizuki produced. They were done with, you have a lot of shoot style guys on there, so a lot of Dragon Gate guys, and a lot of guys that are just, you know, they are Masaki Mochizuki's friends, and he put together some real interesting cards. So the first show was on the 7th, had Tomonahawk TT and Takeshi Minamino, who's popped up in Dragon Gate in 2020, going against Takafumi Watanabe and Chihiro Tomonaga case in the opener match, TT over Tomonaga with a night ride. Lingerie Mudo versus Jackson, Florida. I believe it's not this time, but within like the next like year and a half, Minori Sawa would retire because Battle Arts would shut down. So you had like a comedy match here. Then you have like this match that's just a wild match that happened. Naoki Tanizaki and Fujita Jr. Hayato defeat the team of Kagetora and Kotoka with Hayato defeating Kotoka with the kid. That was a really fun match.
That match sounds incredible. I need to go back and rewatch that.
And then it gets even better from there because we have BB Hulk and KZ going against Daichi Hashimoto and Yoshikazu Yokoyama. Hulk defeated Yokoyama with the first flash. And then the first main event of this match, who boy of the show, this is a spicy one. Shinjiro Otani, Ikuto Hidaka, and Daisuke Sekimoto defeat the team of Masachi Mochizuki, Susumu Yokosuka, and Shingo Takagi. Hidaka defeated Yokosuka with a Shawn capture. Just an insane match. Like one of those deep like hit matches where all six guys were going at it and they just worked so well together. And it's a special match. And if there's one thing that I would love to see in 2021, and I don't think it's going to happen, I want Byuden back because Byuden would put together main events like this. Just insane things. Like, what were your big thoughts about this one?
Well, I mean, I watched all these shows years ago. It has been a long time since I have seen them. But looking at it now, that main event between Otani, Sekimoto, Mochizuki, Yokosuka, and Takagi, we're talking about five of arguably, and that is, you know, my thoughts on Sekimoto. I've certainly turned a bit of a cold shoulder to him in recent years because I just don't love his current output. But historically, we're talking about five of maybe the 50 best wrestlers to ever live, and Akuto Hadaka is no slouch. So that is just an incredible main event. The amount of talent in one ring is second to none.
And then the next night, we had an opener. We had a pre-show match where Masaaki Mochizuki defeated Hikaru Sato with a face punch. He punched him in the face and he won. Welcome to Biodin. That stuff happens. Match two was Satoshi Kajiwara, Yun Nishikawa, and Kito Miyahara defeating Kenichi Arai, Yosuke Watanabe, and Chihiro Tomonaga. Don't remember who the finish was. I don't have it marked here, but it was with a moonsault press. Kiku-san Hansen defeated Bruiser Ichikawa in 4 minutes and 36 seconds. You had Kikutaro versus Stalker Chikawa, the two best comedy wrestlers of all time, doing Hansen versus Bruiser Brody things. Daisuke Sekimoto defeated Tomahawk TT in 7 minutes with a high-angle German suplex. Yes, Sekimoto versus T-Hawk was on the show as a singles match. BB Hulk and Takuya Sugawara defeated Kness and Akuto Hadaka. Take out Sugawara there, and I think that's a tremendous match. And then the main event, another crazy main event. Masaaki Mochizuki, Susumu Yokosuka, and Shingo Takagi defeat the team of Kazuhika Nakajima, Fujita Jr. Hayato, and Munenori Sawa. Yokosuka defeated Sawa in 19 minutes and 9 seconds with the Jumbo no Kachi Gatame. And we will be talking more about Biden by, like, if not the next set of shows, we'll be talking about them in 2012 because it comes back in on November 11th as Mochizuki was impressed by the fight that Sato gave him. He took a punch to the face and he was like, you know what? You could stick around in Biodin. And these are really awesome shows. I don't know who has the rights to these shows. They did get around in the tape trader days and they're worth seeking out because it's just, I mean, with like the blood sports of the world and the paradigms and all that stuff, check out these. This is like the real good stuff.
Well, I would think Gaiora owns them. I don't know if they're originally aired by Gaiora, but the Punch Tomonaga debut match happened on a Biodin show, and that is on the network. So there's at least some possibility that one day these will pop up on the network. And I would like to see Daisuke Sekimoto versus 2020 T-Hawk. I think that would be very entertaining.
Yeah, that would be kind of remarkable. And Case, I think that's it for the mailbag, unless there's anything big you... Or not the mailbag, sorry. The timeline, unless you have anything big you want to touch on before we get into the show itself.
We'll do a mailbag show one of these days. Well, we'll do that. Quickly. There are four notes from the Dragon Gate USA Newswire. On July 18th, Yamato versus Shima was signed for the Open, the Freedom Gate belt. On July 21st, the continuation of the Ricochet versus Pac Challenge Series was announced. It will be a singles match between Pac and Ricochet on this show. August 11th, it is announced that Sabu is coming to Dragon Gate USA, debuting on September 10th in Chicago, and AR Fox wants him as his partner, so we have that to look forward to. And then finally, August 18th, a four-way freestyle match with Junction 3's Yamato, Blood Warriors Naruki Doi, Ronin's Chuck Taylor, and the DUF Sammy Callahan is announced, with the caveat that the winner of the match will have the power to book any bout he wants for their stable at a future Dragon Gate USA event. This could be a title match, this could be a stipulation match, whatever the winner wants. The balance of power could shift in this all-important freestyle match.
Yeah, so that's a... We have that going in here, and something that I do not, like, when I watch these shows, I go through some of the notes and some things I didn't. I did have a moment on the show where I was like, oh, wait, where is Sammy Callahan? And then I scrolled on down on a cage match. I was like, oh, yeah, no, he's in the next match. So a lot of stuff going into the show, in case I think we're ready to get underway with the show review, if you're ready.
I am ready to be untouchable, Mike. I'm ready to open the Untouchable Gate 2011.
Well, it's not Open the Untouchable Gate anymore. It's just Untouchable.
Come on, Mike. I didn't have a transition there. Got to work with me.
Well, I was going to make a comment about being untouchable three times, and that just, you know, not going to work here. That was not going to happen. So, Untouchable 2011, attendance is reported as 783 on Cage Match. It realistically is reported by Dave Meltzer as about 500, and that about is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. I would say, I would guess about 400, maybe 350 in Chicago for the show.
I it's impossible to say because they ran a show in the dark. I mean, there are no lights turned on in this Congress Theater with the exception of a few lights to light up the ring. So it is really hard to say how many people are at this building because you cannot see the crowd at any point in this show.
I mean, that's the story of the Congress Theater, really. Like, from the time that we lost Davy Richards in the lights to now, you get lights when they come out, and you can kind of see them, but really, if they are ever in the crowd, you've got no chance to see them. But getting to the show itself, I thought this was a decent show. There was one match that I really loved, and then there was some matches that I thought were pretty solid. Nothing especially blow away, and even the stuff that I thought was kind of on the lower end was not outright bad. What were your thoughts overall?
I like the show. There's some head-scratching booking, some stuff I wasn't really satisfied with, but overall there were two really great matches and one match that I thought was really, really good. So I'll take that as a plus. Given the Northeast triple shot we discussed, this show is just such a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, no, this show, especially after like the anniversary weekend, they've now put together two strong shows on this triple shot. So I think that if anything, we're not completely, the tail of the DGUSA plane has not started to gain back elevation yet, but we are not going downhill right now because we were definitely going downhill leading into that last triple shot, but we've started to level things out, and this turned out to be a respectable show in my opinion. So it opened up with a shot of the ring. We could actually see the ring this time, not much of the rest of the venue, and that led to I think it was called like the tag team tag team discovery match.
Yes.
My apologies. Between the scene of Caleb Conley and Scott Reed versus the Kentucky Buffet of Alex Castle and Matt Cage. The scene, one of the obscene on Cage in 3 minutes and 35 seconds, and a decent squash match.
Yeah, I was unfamiliar with Alex Castle, but Matt Cage is a guy who I'm a huge fan of. He retired and then kind of came back to wrestling and is kind of doing stuff here and there. But Matt Cage is someone who, had Dragon Gate USA continued past WrestleMania weekend 2014, he would have absolutely been booked. I mean, he worked some Evolve shows in 2015. I remember thinking when he worked those Evolve shows, like, wow, Gabe should really pick him up. Like, he seems like a guy that would fit into this promotion. I mean, his track record in Evolve, he loses a singles match to AR Fox at Evolve 38. There's a four-way match, and Mike, you'll love this. Evolve 49, Andrew Everett defeats Anthony Nice, Matt Cage, and Peter Casa. So some huge Dragon Gate representation in that match. And then the next night at Evolve 50, he beat Ethan Page in a singles match. Gabe Sapolsky showing he was on the right side of history by having Ethan Page lose. So, you know, Matt Cage is a guy that I liked a lot. He's very young in his career at this point, and the Kentucky Buffet did not bring much to the table. But I thought Scott Reed in particular looked good in this very short squash match.
Prepare for the last five episodes of the series for Cage, and for Case, and I'd have probably our most contentious argument about Ethan Page. I'm fully Ethan Page pilled at this point.
Hey, look, in 2014, I was hashtag all ego, baby. Now, played by Julian, not so much.
What about Body Guy played by Julian?
No, because that fucking sucked too. By that point, I was annoyed with Ethan Page, and it was, you know, God, what a frustrating human being. So much talent, and he's such a fucking asshole about it.
You know, I half expect him, as we're recording for All Out, I half expect him to be in the Casino Battle Royal on Saturday. I kind of want to see him show up there. That would make me very happy. But
well, this episode will come out after that, so please tweet at Fujiheo with two eyes whether or not Mike Spears was right, and more importantly, if he's wrong, let him know that he was incorrect about that prediction.
Yeah, so getting back to the show, after our brief sojourn into our impending battle of Ethan Page, we had Brody Lee coming out, and Big Boots, Matt Cage, Larry Dallas ran out and gets the scene out of the way. And then Brody Lee talks about what he did last year in Chicago, basically interrupting a lot of matches and beating people down. And he says he's doing the same thing this year until someone stops him. And then we have a segue for the Southern Gate pay-per-view DVD that came out only 5 months behind. So we're in a good place right now for DVD production. This is my current thing I fixate on, is how far behind they are on their DVDs. And they're at 5 months for this one. And that leads us into the next match. Do you have any big thoughts about Brody Lee already making this 2010 Redux?
No, I mean, just...
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Remember, this is the first of many Brody Lee appearances that would occur, and I have a hard time believing that Larry Dallas could play Peacemaker when Brody Lee is angry, but I'm willing to suspend my disbelief for the craft.
You know, that's fair. That's a fair point. And then we had John Davis versus Rich Swann. Davis won with 3 seconds around the world and 9 minutes and 3 seconds. I went 3¾ on this match. I thought this match owned for the time, and I feel like this was a really well-worked big guy, small guy match.
I am so glad you have converted to being a John Davis fan. It makes me so happy because
established
this
dominance, baby.
Established dominance. Look, I loved this match because it was a really interesting formula in the sense that Davis is obviously twice the size of Swann, but Swann has the experience and was working on top for a portion of this match. So it was, you know, in a sense, it was, you know, reverse psychology from what we typically see, but it was worked in such a way that it just completely fit what they were going for. John Davis gets a big, big spot where he kicks out of the standing 450. I don't believe anybody had done that previously in this company.
No.
I can't believe I'm saying this. I mean, I'm supporting John Davis, and I'm about to talk about how good the strikes are. Maybe this is turning into a Segunda Keita podcast, not a Voices of Wrestling podcast. But John Davis and Rich Swann were throwing some great punches, and that's just something that I've never cared about, never really, you know, want to analyze. But in this match, it jumped out at me like, wow, these guys really can throw some strikes. And then John Davis hits the 3 seconds around the world for the win. I've complained in the past about how weak Rich Swann has been booked compared to how talented he is, and that has bugged me. But I am all aboard the John Davis train right now, and it was the proper move to sacrifice Rich Swann in this situation.
And they made this in a way where Rich Swann was, in like the early parts of the match, it was like he had to like avoid, it was all evasion, evasion, evasion. Like there was a moment where he tries to go for like a springboard arm drag, and Davis stops him, flips him up, throws him over his head. That was amazing. And then it became the story of that whenever he had the opportunity to, Rich Swann went for everything. He went for the same 450. He did a really beautiful top rope frog splash. Nothing was working. His every big shot he had didn't work. So then he was like, well, I'm going to start flipping around and see if something connects. It looks like he was going to go for like some sort of a space flying tiger elbow into the corner, and Davis caught him on his shoulders halfway through, spun him around with 3 seconds around the world, pinned him clean, and it was like a sub 10 minute awesome match. I went 3¾. Where were you on this one?
3.5. I can't believe you are higher than me on this, because I didn't think you were going to be crazy about this match. I thought I was going to have to talk you into a 3.5, and here you are going 3¾.
Established dominance, baby. That's what I'm all about right here. Then Brody Lee came out. He gave Swann a big boot, and then something that kind of became a trend for Brody Lee on the show, one of the laziest power bombs we've ever seen.
Kevin Nash, like, brother, it's the Kevin Nash tribute spot.
Yeah, Kevin Nash put him over, and now he's going to be doing that. And then he had an inaudible Brody promo. We are in we are in WWN in 2011. You can't hear anything.
That's important. Mike mentions that because there is something later on in the show that is a feat of production, but we cannot hear live promos. Now, the last time we were in this building, September 25th, 2010, I heard every word of Brody Lee's promo. I don't know what changed in the last year to make Gabe Sapolsky, he's unable to work a PA system. I don't understand it.
It's something that, like, was he just using the G-Funk pay-per-view soundboards? And now he had to go get his own soundboard, and Gabe Sapolsky, being notoriously cheap, got the cheapest mic and soundboard possible. I mean, he would not have to bring his own soundboard here. This was a theater. They would have a house system.
Like, yeah, no, there was no excuse for this. There's no excuse to not be able to hear a promo.
Yeah, he seemed to be, so, can't hear. I've seen the beat opening challenge. Greg Iron answered just like he did in Indianapolis. And then commentary put over the Punk and Nash thing over, did a he got fired chat. You can make out some disability bullshit they did. Again, I'm not a big fan of that. Brody was acting like, oh, I'm going to get a high five with a guy with cerebral palsy. Really kind of lame stuff. Iron attacked, but then was quickly laid out, and Brody did a mocking pin, and he wanted more. And who answered it, Case?
My man, Uha Nation, answered the call.
Yeah, the one man nation, you know, one nation under God. That promo still
liberty,
makes me
liberty and justice for no one. The greatest promo I've ever heard. It's Kane Dewey, it's the Punk Pipe Bomb, and it's Uha Nation's Dragon Gate USA debut promo.
So he answers, he immediately does a German suplex, power slam, does the fireman's carry, shooting star, tries to go for the moonsault, misses the moonsault of the Uha combination, and then Brody hits a really heavy looking power bomb and then escapes, knowing that these two guys are now on a collision course, and I'm ready for that match. And then we had a DUF and AR Fox recap.
So let's talk about this Brody Lee segment.
Yep.
He kills Rich Swann, which, look, I've given up on Gabe caring about Rich Swann. I don't understand why Gabe doesn't like this guy, but he clearly doesn't. So Swann loses, and then Brody beats him up even more. Not crazy about that, but I'll accept it. Greg Iron comes out. Look, it's Gregory Iron. I'm sure he was comfortable with the direction that things went. Not my thing. I wouldn't really want it on my show. I don't think it's like this malicious bullying thing, though, given all the nice things I've heard about Brody Lee and just knowing who Gregory Iron is to some extent. Again, not my thing. I don't think it's like this malicious hazing attempt, but they go through those. The cool thing in the Gregory Iron spot is he dodges a bunch of Brody Lee strikes, and it's like a mini hope spot before his head gets kicked off. And then Uha Nation comes out, and no one knows who Uha is. He comes out, he hits two big moves, he does the start of the Uha combination, and then Brody rolls out of the way on that moonsault. And that should have been it. He should have rolled out of the ring and hightailed it up the entranceway. And quite honestly, we should have never seen Brody Lee again for the entire show. That should have been his segment. Why he came back, hit a big move on Uha Nation, left him laying, and then we would see Brody as we go along again, I do not understand. We are now seeing the start, and we talked about this, I don't know if it was last week or the week before, I don't remember the exact show, but the pattern of booking that Dragon Gate USA ended up adopting of match angle. It looks like a TEW game, the way that Gabe is currently booking. There's just no real flow to it, and Brody Lee is the ultimate victim of this, because he's all over the show just interfering and doing all this nonsense. There was no reason for him to hit a big move on Uha Nation. There was no reason for them to be even. Okay, this should have been Uha's moment that Brody escaped, and they should be building to a singles match between the two, which, off the top of my head, I don't know if it ever happens. I don't believe it did, which, God, that's even more upsetting. I hated this, because Brody, I mean, look, I still think Brody Lee should be challenging for the title. I'm pissed we didn't get a Brody Lee-Yamato match, but Brody's doing this thing where he just beats up on these smaller guys, and finally a guy his size comes out, he evens the score, and they have the least effective brawl possible. And I just don't understand it.
It's really, really bad. It's something that, like, with how Uha is and how it's going to be a huge ascent with Uha Nation. He's going to be someone that's going to be such a guy. Like, we don't have a lot of Uha Nation. Like, he's in WWE very quickly, but when he's in the company, he's such an impactful person that, like, you don't need to have this happen. I mean, Uha would be out of DGUSA by 2013. So, like, we have 2 years of Uha Nation, and then he finishes up in Dragon Gate and then goes and gets signed in 2015.
So, well, he misses an entire year, so we really only have a collective year of Uha in Dragon Gate USA.
Right, yeah. So it's frustrating. It's one of those things that match never happens, and we'll get into why that match doesn't happen on future episodes. But we did have a match that would happen. We had the DUF versus AR Fox recap. We don't really need to go over that. It's what they gave match angle video package. And then we had Pac versus Ricochet and their big match in the United States. And it was a ridiculous match. Pac won with the British Airways. In case I went 4.25 stars on this match. This was the match of the night.
Wow. Okay. So you're higher than me on this, which is interesting because, you know, Lenny Leonard does a really good job on commentary of saying that this is the new age Tiger Mask versus Dynamite Kid, which I think it is. I mean, I've always said, and it's true, all of Ricochet's success can be credited to Pac, because without Pac and without Dragon Gate, Ricochet is just a dude in Ian Rodden's barn doing flips, okay? So, mm-hmm. Ricochet from December 2010, when he debuts in the company, to December 2011, is an entirely different human. And the consistency there is he spends an entire calendar year working with Pac, and Pac convinces him to stick to a diet, to stick to working out, and most importantly, makes him the foundations of the Ricochet that we know today. I mean, he's just a brilliant professional wrestler who was a dork on Twitter and is misused by the company he works for now, but it is all thanks to this 2011 feud with Pac, and you watch so much of the stuff Pac does, and it clearly influenced the next generation of Flyers, the Will Ospreys of the world. It is a direct lineage from what Pac was doing. The funny thing is, I love this match. I think it's the weakest singles match of their three in 2011. I went 3.75 with it.
That's fair. That's fair. The thing that really, like, set me off about this when I was watching this, I really struck me is we don't talk about how effortless Pac is.
He's unbelievable. There's no one like him. The biggest takeaway from this series so far, and we've said it a bunch, is just how good Pac is. There's no one like him.
And it's something that, like, we've talked about him in current day a lot. We've talked about how, you know, I mean, this is a guy that we're now coming up on almost 2 years of his career lost for no reasons of his own, or for him taking a stand and saying, I am not going to lose Enzo Amore again. You know, I mean, valid reasons, justified reasons in my mind. And in 2011, he already is this completely dynamic guy doing things like a standing corkscrew moonsault, no effort in the world. Second rope Phoenix Splash does not faze him. Insane set of Dragon Ranas. This was a show that had a lot of Dragon Ranas on it. And these two really ruled. And then we had, like, this, probably for, like, all of Brody Lee's power bombs. The power bomb in this match that Pac is Ricochet is one of the more brutal ones I've ever seen. Like, it might be like a top five Liger bomb ever. And it's just something that it was incredibly well worked. It was immediate sprint, and then Ricochet, realizing he was in out of his depth, pulls Pac to the outside and tries to crowd brawl, and it doesn't go well for him, but he knows, I have to get out of the ring with this guy or he's going to eat me alive. And then he gets momentum and they're able to go back and forth in, you know, 10 minutes. And I thought this match was excellent.
You know what I really like about these two together, and specifically the story that was told in 2011, is you look at the results and Ricochet just beat Pac at Kobe World for the Twin Gate belts. The Spike Mohicans seem to have the upper hand on Pac no matter who he's teaming with or where he goes. The night before, Ricochet wins the six-man tag, but as we saw on the March Quirkin, on the June Champion Gate show, and now in Chicago on Untouchable 2011, when it comes to one-on-one affairs, when it comes to singles matches, Pac still has the upper hand, and it is a really interesting story being told between the two.
Yeah, it's something that, with, like, the power of hindsight, and I know other stuff was going on in 2011, this might be, and when we get to it, I'm definitely going to be searching this out on, like, the feud of the year and, like, things like this for, like, awards. This is up there. Like, I know, like, with CM Punk, like, that got a lot of attention here, but I think a lot of people slept on this feud initially.
Oh, completely. I mean, they slept on Pac just throughout this point in his career. He should have been praised as one of the five best wrestlers in the world, and I really don't know how many people were out there touting that as such. I mean, this is stuff that I loved my first or second time watching, but it's only now that I realize that I was severely underrating the work he did in 2011, and I point to Pac's 2011 as, like, an all-time great run, and I still think I was underrating it.
It's insane, and, you know, we're going to get to a point where, like, I didn't get a chance to rewatch a lot of the Japanese shows, but I am definitely, before the end of the feud, I'm going to rewatch every single Pac and Ricochet match. And just, like, just because it's one of those things that I think that watching of 2020 eyes, really, I think that Pac, and I said this a couple weeks ago, Pac might be the wrestler of the decade of the 2010s, and that's taking a lot of the time off of because he left WWE, sat at home for 18 months, and then, you know, AEW, he came in and he had a solid end of 2019, and now he's gone again. And I think that he's someone that in 2018, 2019, I thought that he had claims for being the wrestler of the year. And I'm looking back at this in 2011, I'm wondering, and it's in the back of my head, I was like, no, because Masaaki Mochizuki is insane right now. But it goes into your head. It goes into your head.
Well, specifically when discussing wrestler of the decade, I mean, for me, it has to be the non-Okada division, because I don't think anyone was in Okada's universe. But if you want to remove him from the conversation, I do look at Pac as being on the level of an Ishii or a Shingo or a Mochizuki, because the thing that I touted for so long was that once Pac got called to the main roster, and that's leaving behind the great work he did in NXT, but once he got called up to the main roster, he was the best main roster worker until he left the company. That includes, you know, the matches with John Cena, the matches, he had a great Raw match with Seth Rollins, probably one of the last Raws I watched now that I think about it. He had great matches with Kevin Owens. His run as a cruiserweight champion was excellent. He was great on 205 Live while he was there. He was consistently week in, week out, the best worker on the WWE main roster. And then he left, comes to Dragon Gate, becomes Wrestler of the Year, at least in our books. And then, you know, obviously, we were on the cusp of Death Triangle, which I can only dream about how good that would have been in my AEW TEW save. Pac won the world title at All Out 2020 and has held the title for 18 months now. No one can compete with Pac in my universe. And it all starts, like, he really just becomes otherworldly in 2011.
Yeah. So this is a match really worth going out of your way for. I'm a little bit higher on the, I think I might be higher. No, we're going to get to matches on the show that I'm not a big fan of. Never mind. I just looked at what we're going to be talking about next. So,
well, explain this abomination of a post-match angle. Why don't you?
Yeah, like, that's the thing about the show is that we're three matches in. We have two matches that, at least in my books, are either notebook or verging on notebook level. A decent little squash, and then, like, Brody Lee stuff that's, you know, we've talked about enough. And we're going to talk more about Brody Lee again. Because Blood Warriors attack and lay out Pac. Ricochet that he says that he will prove that he's the best high flyer. And then they set him up on the outside, which actually was the cool part of it. They're like, I'm going to prove I'm the best high flyer. And then Ricochet decides to pop a space flying tiger drop.
So that's the part that fucking ruled. That is the storytelling that I love in wrestling. And I think it's so dumb that companies don't have high flyers adapt to that version of storytelling. Lost my mind for Ricochet essentially hitting a cocky space flying tiger drop because he could. And then what happens, Mike?
Ronan comes out for a save. Why were they saving a pack? Don't know. I mean, we saw last night how Chuck Taylor is very anti Junction 3, and he still was coming out for a save, and they did triple dives. Why was Johnny Gargano doing a dive right before he was about to have where he was going to be on deck coming after the next match? Don't know. And then DUF comes out and they triple suplex Pinky Sanchez, and then Sabu runs out and completely botches a dive and pockins this up with an Orihara moonsault. Oh yeah, Air Fox does a dive in the middle of this too.
Yeah, so
why?
So it's a Ronin dive, an AR Fox dive, a DUF suplex, which I actually thought that was creative. That was Eric Cannon almost blew out his ACL doing it, but it was creative in the sense that they suplexed Pinky Sanchez onto everyone. And then what I don't understand is, and it is clear coming out of the show and the next five shows that occur throughout the year, I guess the next four shows, how much Gabe Sapolsky loves Sabu. More power to him.
Yep.
But if you're going to book Sabu to show up and do a big dive spot, why did he just jog down the entrance ramp? Why did the lights not go out and Sabu show up in the middle of the ring with his finger pointed at the sky? Like, they couldn't even do the Sabu debut right. I don't understand how they messed that up when it is clear that Gabe's focus from here on out is Sabu, 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 and he botches the debut.
And this is a cardinal sin. Like, Sabu is a cardinal sin in this promotion because there'll be a plight of Sabu through WrestleMania in 2012. Like, and that's a lot of shows. We're talking about the five shows in the rest of this year, and then... I believe there was a January set of shows.
There's a January single shot, but Sabu's not on that show.
Yeah, but then you have like that through WrestleMania next year. Sabu is a huge misstep here, how the promotion suddenly all becomes about Sabu. Like Sabu, and when we go through like the news wires, the news bulletins, the news express, whatever the fuck he called it. Sorry, I was good one week about not cussing this week. Sabu,
that's a self-imposed rule. That's your rule. You can do whatever you want, Mike.
Yeah, Sabu comes out, and then we start the... it's just hideous. It's completely, like, does not make sense. Does Sabu really push the tickets in 2012? We're really at a situation where you do not trust your promotion. They had to bring in Sabu for this long. Who? It's Sabu in 2012. He is not good. Like, I know there's a lot of people like, oh, yeah, it's Sabu, he owns. No, he doesn't. He doesn't own 2012. He's a shell of who he was. And who he was someone I think is one of the most overrated high flyers of all time. So,
I'm not ready to take that step. I am going to push back a little bit. I was going to ask you what you thought about Sabu historically, because for me, and I don't know how it came across the hardcore fan at the time, but I know... my wrestling viewing started in early 2006, and I was so on board with the sci-fi beginning of ECW, the reincarnation. I was so excited about that as a kid, because however they marketed it, it worked for me. And specifically, I thought Sabu was the coolest dude ever when he showed up on WWE TV. My favorite wrestlers growing up was like Rey Mysterio, Paul London, and Brian Kendrick, and Sabu. That's who was over with me, and I became an immediate fan as soon as I saw him. I remember specifically hunting down the Sabu action figure. That was like a huge thing for me to get. And then a few years later, you know, I went back and watched all this ECW stuff. I mean, that was when I got back into wrestling, just because of the availability of it. Because at the time, all of the WWE-produced ECW documentaries were available on Netflix. So I went through, like, a whole thing of watching the greatest hits of ECW. And my love of Sabu held up then. And then you go through the post-ECW years and the post-WWE run. And we hit 2011 Sabu, and I'm just not crazy about that. And I think his output was personified in the Eric Cannon and Pinky Sanchez versus AR Fox and Sabu match.
It's just, I'm maybe like in ECW in 2006, I was like, okay, that's cool, whatever. You know, like at that age. But then again, at that age also, I was mostly on the outs of wrestling, and then I got really back in during college, as I also got super into Dragon Gate. You know, like that was when I really started getting to Chikara and Dragon Gate, so I really didn't have a need to go seek out Sabu. And then whenever you watch ECW, I'm like, okay, he's there. Like, time and place for the guy. I respect that. But we had AR Fox and Sabu defeat Eric Cannon and Pinky Sanchez when AR Fox does a 450 on top of a table that's laid across of Pinky Sanchez. I'm trying to think of like how to tackle this match. this is probably, from what I remember, the high point of this feud. And it kind of goes downhill from here. I went two and three quarters. You know, like, it for what it was, like, the finish got me back into it. It just was like, how this turned into, like, a straight tag match of no DQ when you had Sabu there makes zero sense to me. Like, why did they work, like, a straight tag match instead of, like, a brawl that ended with, like, with a crazy spot? Like, when you have, like, these guys.
So that's exactly what I was going to say, was I went 2 3/4 with the note being, it's really weird to think that they worked this match like a Southern-style tag where A.R. Fox gets beaten down and then Sabu makes a hot tag. And then as soon as Sabu makes the tag, he goes into all the weapon spots and the match breaks down. But the majority of this match is like a structured tag team match, and it just made no sense.
It made no sense. The finishing stretch was cool. I thought, like using the plunder and then, like, reusing the table and go, like, you really try to hurt me. I'm fucking you up with this broken table was kind of neat. I thought that was kind of cool, but it was a weird match, you know? Not a huge fan of it.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, unfortunately, well, I think there's a Sabu match coming up that was critically acclaimed at the time, but there are no members of the DUF involved, so we will cross that bridge when we come to it.
We will. We had a WWN live promo, and then we had a Johnny Gargano video package, which I had to remind myself that the Indianapolis show was not on pay-per-view. So this covered, like, I assume this is something he put out on YouTube. I don't even know if, like, the WWN live YouTube exists after the WWE acquisition.
It does.
So I don't know.
It does.
It does.
It's, the most reliable place to find Dragon Gate USA content, quite honestly.
Yeah. So... this video, it talks about his path of his history in Dragon Gate USA, his eras, as he put it. It was really well done, and then I realized, wait, this is like a 5-minute video that they put together for this, and I was like, at the end of it, I was like, okay, all right. But, you know, it was really effective, and if it's something that you're, like, trying to watch, like, early history of Johnny Gargano, if this is on the DGUSA YouTube, it's worth doing, but it's not worth having a 5-minute interlude. I guess it was, like, used as part of an intermission for a show. Like, this is something that, like, if this was like 2 minutes, totally cool, makes sense. But how this thing felt like it dragged towards the end of it, or that just might be me being cranky while watching it.
No, it was, so here's the frustrating part. It is such a well done video on the same show that is occurring in near pitch black conditions with a live mic that won't work. They're able to produce this video package. It's so frustrating that it's the same company, but you are right. It's a 5-minute package that realistically probably needs to go 3.5, but it is effort being put into the product, so I'm not going to complain about it.
And it makes sense, and at this point, everyone watching this and following along should know Gargano's the next guy. Like, they've done an excellent job of, like, this is Johnny Gargano's quest to the title, and it's continues with Akira Tozawa defeating Johnny Gargano in 20 minutes and 32 seconds with the straightjacket German suplex. What were your thoughts on this?
Well, I'm curious, what was your star rating here?
3 3/4.
Okay, so we flip-flopped on the Pac and Ricochet and Tozawa versus Gargano match. I went 4 1/4. Yeah. I'm surprised it's whatever, 3 3/4 is fine. I'm surprised you weren't as high on this as I was. Historically, this was their second singles match. They wrestled at AIW's J-Lit tournament in May. I believe that match is up for free on YouTube. And then, you know, they have this match, and I'm really conflicted about it because it is a great match. I mean, it is a level above what we've seen Gargano work at. It's obviously, it's Tozawa. He's been killing it all 2011. There's a ton of great moves in this match. The bicycle kick into the German on the apron. Tozawa starts going for a dive train and gets interrupted with the rope-assisted spear that Gargano does.
That was really cool.
Tozawa gets cut open in the match. It's like his ears bleeding. There's another great moment where Gargano goes for a poison Rana, and Tozawa just throws him off of his shoulders and then hits a bridging German suplex, and then he gets the capture German for the win. But the issue is that we just saw this video package with Johnny Gargano and how he is the next guy, and I understand why they're positioning him like that, and I agree with it. But he loses every big match he's in. He lost the United Gate Tag Titles match. He lost the Mercury Rising Six-Man. He's lost twice to Shima in a singles match. I understand that he submitted both Shima and Aries, but the dude keeps losing. I don't get it.
Yeah, no, it's something where... I mean, Gabe, at the time it was kind of like frustrating. It's like, oh no, Gargano's going to be the guy. Gargano's going to be the guy. This is going to happen. This is going to be this happening. But it felt like he was like dipping the toe in the water, and you had the whole thing of Chuck Taylor at the same time saying, no, I'm going to be the guy, which was, I feel like if they were going to tell one story, they should have picked Taylor and Gargano both gunning for the top. Like, they seem like that's a story that would have played out a lot better. My issue with this match was the crowd was dead. The crowd at this point, after Sabu, the crowd was super dead and never really picks up for the rest of the show. For a match like this that goes 20 minutes long and is very much built on, like, you're trying to get, like, Tozawa is a known commodity at this point. Like this is not Akira Tozawa of 2010. This is 2011, Akira Tozawa is going to murder you, Akira Tozawa. And as we talked about earlier, on the biggest run of his career at this point. Like, he is owning Shingo Takagi in singles matches. Him and Yamato has been back and forth. So, I mean, he's a main event guy. But the crowd could not get behind the idea of the young up-and-comer trying to go up against his established guy. Because all the things that you mentioned, I have every single one of those written in my notebook as, like, awesome moments. Because the finishing stretch, like, going for the poison run, and Tozawa slides out, grabs him, does one German suplex, does not get the pin there, and immediately goes for the straight jacket and wins. Awesome closing stretch. But the crowd was dead, and at this certain point, and the crowd never comes back. And that's, like, the thing that, like, if the crowd was, like, more into it, like the J-Lit match, that would be a 4-star, 4.25, maybe verging on 4.5-star match in my book. But with how it was in the match that they had that day in front of that crowd, it was 3.75.
I will say this now before we get to the match. I noticed the dead crowd more so in the main event rather than this match. I think we'll talk about it in just a second. I like the main event a lot. I love the main event, but it was noticeable that the crowd was not super into it. But before we get to that, there's another match to talk about.
Well, there's also another announced DVD release. It's Mercury Rising this time. So he's gone from being 8 months behind to now being 5 months behind. So, you know, they're staying good. He's staying good about this kind of stuff.
Yeah, congrats.
This is my own personal obsession. I apologize, Case.
Well, I was the one that initially brought it up. I'm glad you've taken the reins on this and care about it as much as I do, quite honestly.
Yeah. So then we have the four-way fray that was talked about. Or, sorry, four-way freestyle. It's not a fray match. It's a freestyle. Those are different things.
Please, Mike. It's a freestyle, not a fray.
the series is three matches. Actually, the third match is two matches together. Sorry. I whenever I think about that, I laugh. And that's what I kind of remind me of. So it's four-way freestyle representing the four stables: Chuck Taylor of Ronin, Masato Yoshino of Junction 3, Naruki Doi of Blood Warriors, and Sammy Callahan of DUF. Taylor gets the win on Callahan in 10 minutes and 18 seconds with the awful waffle. And I like how, my first note, I love how Doi and Yoshino vetted their way into treating this like an off night.
It's funny. They treated this as an off night, and I still thought they were the best parts of the match. The Doi-Yoshino interactions were great. And I have two notes on commentary here. One, when this match starts, Gabe Sapolsky comes in the booth and yells that Sabu is going to be in Milwaukee. I'm sorry, Jimmy Bauer yells dangerous that Sabu is going to be in Milwaukee. Fuck off with that. I cannot believe he did that. But there's another thing a few minutes later where Doi and Yoshino are in the ring, and it's a great wrestling commentary moment where Doi offers Yoshino a handshake, and Lenny is like, well, don't shake that. He turned his back on you. Naruki Doi caused upheaval in two countries by turning on Masato Yoshino. And it's just one of those things that I really like about the idea of, like, Americans being pissed at Naruki Doi. Like, he did what to Masato Yoshino? And it was just a nice Lenny Leonard moment.
Lenny, the MVP of Dragon Gate USA.
Oh, it's not even close.
Yeah, no, like, this was a Doi-Yoshi singles match that had Chuck Taylor and Sammy Callahan come in at certain moments and then get
just
and then have the
finish. Some spots, but it was mainly Doi and Yoshino just being really good at wrestling.
Being really good at wrestling and being really good at being like, oh, y'all do all the heavy parts, we'll come in at the end and do our, like, 2 minute stretch, and then you two do your finish.
And that was Taylor pinning Callahan with the awful waffle, which gives Ronan the advantage to book whatever match they want, which leads into yet another post-match angle.
Yep, something that was Chuck at least projects so other microphones picked up on him. He said that Ronan's coming for all the belts and that Swan and Gargano are going for the United belts. So I guess he made the match for the two of them to go over and take the tag team titles, which, you know, pretty sneaky idea there, because that means you can have the advantage of trying to go after Yamato there, Chuck. Like, I thought that that was actually a pretty cunning thing. Then Brody Lee comes in and Chuck and Yoshino lay them out. Yoshino says anytime, and then Chuck lays out Yoshino just like the night before. And Rich Swann, yet again, is the man in the middle.
I love what they're doing with Swann. I love what they're doing with Ronan, actually. I think Taylor and Gargano butting heads is really interesting, too. Why did Brody Lee need to come out to get beat up? I don't understand that at all. He ran in the ring, and Taylor and Yoshino kicked him out of the ring. What purpose did that serve? This is a guy that, again, if I had it my way, he'd be challenging Yamato for the Open the Freedom Gate title, and instead, he's getting in sloppy brawls with UHA Nation, and then running it and getting his ass kicked by Chuck Taylor. The mismanagement of Brody Lee is abhorrent.
Case, is it? Is it a cardinal sin?
It's tough to say. I need to sit on that a little bit, but at least locate your expo marker in case it needs to go on the whiteboard. I will hypothesize about this idea. I heard the expo marker there. I will at least hypothesize about the idea, and four shows from now when Brody Lee says farewell, I will give you an answer.
I will remind you this at the end of the 2011 shows.
Please.
This time. It is on the whiteboard.
Oh, boy. I love making the whiteboard. Well, I don't know about your whiteboard. I do know that this main event made my spreadsheet. How did you feel about Yamato versus Shima for the Open the Freedom Gate title?
This is pretty much like the most on-brand thing for me. 3.5 stars. They did a Dreamgate match against a dead crowd when Yamato is like suddenly lost all of his charisma because he's wearing the green tights.
You're exactly right. It is a Dreamgate structure of a match, which I'm a fan of, because by the end of it, I was going, holy shit, Shima is so good. But you're right. There's like, you know, a 6 or 7 minute portion there where it's not the most exciting match. The crowd's not into it. It's an interesting point in their career where they were 1-1-1 in non-Young Boy singles matches, because Shima killed Yamato when he still had his last name and his name wasn't capitalized. But after that, they were 1-1-1. This was, you know, the rubber match of their careers up to this point. They only had one more singles match after this. And I really like this match. It is really stiff. Yamato works over Shima's leg a ton. Shima does a great job of selling it. And then down the stretch, when Shima is building momentum, but at the same time selling the leg, is where he really, really shines. And specifically, he hits a big meteor on Yamato. It comes across like it could be the finish, but Shima has to stop. He has to check on his leg. He's too hurt to make the immediate cover. Yamato kicks out. He's screaming. Yamato kicks out. And then with that, Yamato is able to recover, battle back, hit the Galleria for the win. It is, in the same way that we have our Gentleman's 3, this is a Gentleman's 4. I recognize what they were doing was great. The live crowd just did not care about it.
The crowd after intermission did not care about the show, and it actively hampered the show a whole ton. And as I said, like, I liked, and it was something that at least those 7 minutes of the slow opening Dreamgate match that began to loathe out of Yamato paid off at the end, because Shima was cognizant of selling the knee. Because after that Meteora, it was one of, like, when Shima really hits a guy with a Meteora and they sell it like death, the Meteora is one of the coolest moves in wrestling. And it's such a simple move. You're jumping off the top rope and you're kneeing the guy and you're deciding, I'm going to pin your shoulders to my net with my knees. I'm going to come in at full force and it's going to knock all the air out of you. And it's going to look brutal. It looks great. And the idea that he hits one of those really clean meteoras and then immediately rolls off him, he's not able to capture the legs on the way down because his knees are hurting that bad, was an incredible moment. And then they did like this really cool counter where Yamato goes to the Dojima sleeper a lot in this match. Like at a certain point, he is like, I'm just going to choke this guy out. This guy is just annoying me. and I know I could choke him out. I am an MMA guy. This guy's not an MMA guy. I could choke him out. And Shima converts that into a Schwein that looks awesome. And then the sleeper stuff, like, weakens Shima to a certain point. They do the three-arm thing, which I kind of hate in this match for this. I think, like, the referee should just step in and call it if that's the case. Because it kind of, like, hampers the finishing stretch. Because the finishing stretch is, he basically, when Shima does not go to sleep, he's like, oh, you're weakened enough. Kick, brain buster, put this for a two count. All right, start with the sleeper, drop you down, Galleria, ball game. And it's something that with the crowd, with like all this, it's hard for me to get up on this. I totally understand like vacuum four-star match that this could be. But for me, in the show that was presented here in front of that crowd, it's a 3.5-star match.
I think that's completely fair. And it's unfortunate that the crowd wasn't into really the second half of the show. But I think this match in particular, because if you eliminate the Sabu match from the show, this is a great Dragon Gate USA show. But there's a noticeable before and after. We'll call it the BS era, the before Sabu and the after Sabu. There is a grave difference in not only this show, but just the vibe of the promotion.
Yep, we will be talking about this on the next. This might be like the period of doing the showcase where like each week I'm like, well, I'm going to sit through a Sabu thing. And I'm going to need like a pep talk. I'm going to give myself a pep talk. I'll be staring in the mirror, splash water on my face. Be like, you're going to get through this. You're already like at this point. Get through the Sabu stuff, and there's the finishing stretch, because then you have 2013, and then the beginning of 2014, and that's it, Mike. You can do this. But this Sabu stretch is going to be tough for me, because it's just not my guy. And I understand you could at me about this. Didn't grow up in the ECW era. Wasn't the ECW, WWE thing never really worked for me. So I am like that outlier here, and that really brought down the show. However, finishing the show, Shima grabbed the microphone, stared down Yamato, and said, Hulk is coming back. He's coming back for a no ropes match. And just like makes this thing like the idea that now BB Hulk, who's been basically out of the company or out of the promotion for basically like as soon as he dropped the title and a little bit after hanging out with Homicide, that was it. Hulk has been gone for a long period of time. And we talked about this when this happened. Hulk disappearing because he had come back a completely different character to this. And this really got over the idea that like BB Hulk now is this monster and he's coming in for this. And Yamato said he's not faced because he's a fighting champion and he will be the only champion and he's okay with that. So anytime, any place. And then he gives this might be like the most like Yamato is ever on the mic by himself in front of American audience. He does a pretty solid promo, like getting that over, and closes out with a DGUSA call. And I thought this was a really effective post-match thing.
Yeah, no, really good segment to end. And then, Mike, if you're ready, I think we are ready to close out this show and preview what is coming next week on Way of the Ronin 2011.
Well, we're going to be back in Milwaukee, I know that for sure.
That is true, at the Miramar Theater, where we will see the conclusion of the Tag Team Discovery Tournament as the Scene takes on Ronin of Chuck Taylor and Rich Swann. We'll have Silas Young and Brody Lee going at it. What has become a Mike Spears dream match in John Davis versus Akira Tozawa.
And yes, I am stoked. Let's go. Let's go.
Well, settle down, because from there we go with AR Fox and Yamato against Callahan and Cannon. A singles match between Sabu and Peaky Sanchez. Fuck you, Gabe Sapolsky. A four-way freestyle Sugar Dunkerton, Facade, Flip Kendrick, and Uha Nation. Naruki Doi versus Johnny Gargano in a singles match. And then a historic Open the United Gate versus Open the Twin Gate winner-take-all match. Shima and Ricochet versus Masato Yoshino and Pac. That is what is coming up next week.
I am not letting those matches that happen after really like malign Akira Tozawa versus John Davis.
It's your guys.
I'm ready. It's my guys. We get Uha. I hope we get another great Uha promo. Like Gargano versus Doi. Doi's the mayor of Milwaukee.
That's like, right.
There's a lot of this show that like sink my teeth into, even though I'm like looking at like that middle segment, I'm like, oh, there's even Facade I had to sit through.
That's but right. You have Facade and Sabu. This is a tough card, and they're back-to-back. That is a rough section for us.
That's going to be a half hour where afterwards, like, I'm going to get through it. I'm a strong person. I can get through these shows.
You can do it.
I can get through this. I'm right now looking at the cage match thing, which I don't usually put a lot of stock in cage match ratings. It has two ratings, 2011, 8, 2012, 5.
For what is this?
The show rating on cage match.
Word.
There's only two votes, 8 and a 5.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair. Well,
those rings are doing a lot of work. A lot of work there.
I will say I was gravely concerned with the amount of Japan news and notes that we had that this show is going to go a very, very long, but we're right at just about 90 minutes. And Mike, I don't have anything else.
All right, so I'll take us in for a landing. Thank you all for listening.
Land the plane.
You know, we are landing the plane here. Thank you all for listening and joining us on this series. This has been probably one of like my big highlights of this year, especially with COVID, doing this each week, rediscovering this with Case. And I hope that y'all, as much as I feel maligned by Sabu and DOF and Facade, I hope y'all are as enjoying this as much as I am, because this has been an absolute blast. As I just talking about John Davis as a character, that was put a path to my step, Case. So I'm stoked. Thank you all for listening. You can follow the podcast account at Open Voice Gate. You can follow me on Twitter at Fujiheya. You can follow Case at _ in your case. And that's going to do it for this episode of Open the Voice Gate, Rewind and Rewatch. We'll be back with you next week in Milwaukee with the mayor of Milwaukee, Naruki Doi. Take care, everyone.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.